A whole section on this later. For now, basic survival skills. Eat only at the table, only sitting down. Never eat out of cartons. Use real plates and decent napkins if you have them to emphasize the seriousness of the activity. Eat slowly. Chew properly. American mothers tell you this, but tend to see it as a matter of politeness rather than pleasure. Do not watch television or read the paper. Think only about what you are eating, smelling and savoring every bite. Practice putting down your utensils between every few bites, describing to yourself the flavors and textures in your mouth. Don't let anyone mock you for acting like a French woman. You will laugh last. Portion control. Learn it slowly. Portion size has been a losing battle for Americans, a gastronomic Waterloo, in fact. Cut back gently, especially if your problem is too much of a good thing. Salmon is wonderful health food, but if you need half a pound to feel content, you need too much. Keep the scale handy and reduce ounce by ounce until 4 to 6 ounces seems a satisfying amount to you. This point reveals a key grotesquerie of the protein diet. You can stuff yourself silly with bacon as long as bread doesn't pass your lips. Utterly dégueulasse. As a rule, half a pound of anything in one sitting is too much. You won't even notice the change in satisfaction, but the bodily change will astound you. Don't stalk the offenders. Some foods we eat automatically in whatever quantity we have on hand. Can't be content with just a handful of nuts? Don't keep them in the house. Very few of us will go out just to buy a bag of salty nuts or potato chips. If you have them and keep going back for more, try to apply the preceding principle of progressive downsizing. If your first handful is 6, make that the limit. The next time, consider stopping at 3 for the day. Substitution and pacifiers. Knowing my biggest problem was sweets, Dr. Miracle furnished a recipe that provided much of the satisfaction at a fraction of the calories. Like all his best prescriptions, it has remained useful ever since. Apple tart without dough. Serves 4. The following recipe for an apple tart without a crust is less sweet, lower in calories, but more nutritional than what one finds in pastry shops, delis, or supermarkets. Homemade versus prepared food, a universe of difference. Read labels and start avoiding foods whose ingredients sound like chemical weapons. Ingredients: 4 medium-sized, golden, delicious apples, 2 tablespoons lemon juice, 4 cabbage leaves, 1 tablespoon sugar, 1/4 teaspoon cinnamon, dots of butter. 1. Peel and core the apples. Cut into quarters. Slice each quarter into thirds and sprinkle with the lemon juice. Place the apples on the cabbage leaves, shaping the slices like those on a small tart. 2. Preheat the oven to 275 degrees. Mix the sugar with the cinnamon and sprinkle almost all of it on the apple slices, leaving enough to cover the dots of butter. Add small dots of butter and cover with the remaining sugar-cinnamon mixture. Bake the tart in the preheated oven for 15 minutes. Serve warm or at room temperature. You don't need to eat the cabbage leaves, though you can. They are for presentation and don't affect the tart. And yes, after your 3 months, you can go back to having a slice of the real thing, with a pâté brisé crust. Facing nos petits démons. Discretion is often the better part of valor. Dr. Miracle proposed I avoid troublemakers, in my case sweets, as a child is taught to walk away from a fight. It would be better, he said, if at the beginning I went to school without money or no more than I would need for the metro or to buy a cup of coffee. For me, avoidance of the pastry shops also meant varying my route. If you walk to work, don't go the same way every day. Variety is important in environment as well as in nutrition. Dr. Miracle knew Paris well and would test me on all the monuments, public squares, and buildings where famous people lived, Gertrude Stein on Rue de Fleury or Edith Wharton on Rue de l'Université. I found myself entering the porte cochère of every beautiful hôtel particulier on my route to the Sorbonne. No one in my family had been to Paris for more than a brief visit, so they were intrigued as I fell in love with the great city. If your offenders are not lurking in the streets, or your streets are not so compelling, try to stimulate your other senses. One thing drawing me into the patisseries was the heavenly smell of baked goods. Buying some fragrant flowers was not only a treat, but a defense. I'd sniff them when I came near a bakery. Since smell is half of taste, it's hard to crave sweets when you don't smell them. A sachet of fragrant lavender can also do wonders. Move. Perhaps you live in a place where driving is the norm, or perhaps you don't have occasion to walk every day. That does not change the fact that your weight is determined by two variables, what you consume and what you burn off. Dr. Miracle knew I didn't like sports. Most French women don't. But I still needed to me remuer, move my butt. A twice-a-day 20-minute walk to school was the perfect remedy for me. If you live too far from work or school to walk, try walking part of the way, or take a half-hour walk at lunch or after dinner. A walk not only uses calories, it can be wonderfully meditative, clearing your head and making you less vulnerable to eating for psychological comfort. The key is to add moderately to your daily physical exertion. If you use an elevator, try taking the stairs instead. Over the course of a week, the added calories are significant, but the added trouble is minimal. Never be hungry. One of Dr. Miracle's wisest prescriptions, it is especially important in the first weeks of recasting as your body is learning the new world order. Hunger is distracting and unpleasant, almost as much as being bloated or stuffed. You should no more skip meals than you would skip filling your gas tank. You'll only be stranded later. Our aim is not to challenge the laws of physics. Feed it reasonably and on schedule, and your body's engine is less likely to answer you with screaming hunger. Strict attention to this principle is key until the mind has been tamed. One vital secret of hunger management Dr. Miracle taught me is yogurt. Not the sugary supermarket kind, but the real stuff, strained, which is not only of superior texture and flavor, but full of the bacteria essential to health. It isn't readily available in America unless you live near a dairy. But you can make it yourself once a week according to an incredibly easy recipe. Dr. Miracle prescribed 2 small servings a day during recasting, to be had as I wished, with breakfast, as a dessert, or for a snack. A little honey or wheat germ or fresh fruit made it seem more like a treat. But when I developed a taste for it, I began to love it plain for its silky, creamy tartness. A yogurt eaten just when I knew hunger would strike was a terrific pacifier. I've included the recipe later. En cas. We also had to have some provision for off-site emergencies. Dr. Miracle explained what he called my en cas, literally, in case, of hunger attack. It was so simple. Always have a little something in your pocket, something your body will register as a mini-repas, snack. It's not only handy, but a powerful psychological deterrent. It shuts up my petit démon. Knowing it was there made me less anxious, less likely to crave. When I did break out the en cas, enjoying it left me less hungry at dinner time. Compensation. I still carry it. A small bag of soy nuts, which nowadays often appears when my flight is delayed. It should be something good for you, but satisfying. Weekend rewards. Dr. Miracle understood only too well that we are fragile beings in a world full of temptations. Deprivation is the mother of failure. Any program that your mind interprets as punishment is one your mind is bound to rebel against. Whether your pleasure is a glass of wine with dinner or a croissant for breakfast, you simply cannot deprive yourself for extended periods of time and not expect your body to take revenge. So even during recasting, your body needs a Sabbath. Mind you, we are not talking about an all-you-can-eat bender, during which you consume everything you manage to abstain from all week. Rather, this is a day of rest, when you can enjoy a civilized share of some favorites. Some diet authorities advise you not to reward yourself with food, but I say it's okay, as long as the food is rewarding. No junk, good quality, and respectfully savored. Dr. Miracle said it was better to stray on Saturday and go back to the plan on Sunday in order to start the new week on the right track, and it made sense in my case. While I was a student, I was often invited for Saturday supper at the home of some rather fancy friends in Paris. They had a full-time cook, an extraordinary luxury anywhere, whose elaborate offerings made it difficult to pick among my vices. You can see why I held on to these friends. Dr. Miracle's answer? Mais Mireille fait preuve d'intelligence. Just use your head. If a glass of champagne is aperitif and a dessert seem too good to resist, have them. But then don't eat bread. Making choices that are meaningful to you is the essence of the French woman's secret. During this phase of recasting, I was especially worried about going home for Easter in a few weeks and facing an elaborate holiday feast with my family, who were naturally less discreet than my fancy friends in Paris. I was already on the right track, and having lost about 9 pounds, I didn't want to draw attention to myself or to any change in eating habits. Dr. Miracle rightly advised that nobody would notice if I ate my foie gras, skimped on most of the various breads, helped myself to just a few French fries, and enjoyed dessert. The next day, you'll compensate, he said very matter-of-factly. He was telling me to be the master of my pleasures as well as my restraint. Still, I had a lingering question about where this was going in the long run. Alas, it was those demon offenders again. I knew I could keep them on this short leash for only so long. When could I reintegrate them into the school week without bringing on my downfall? True, I wasn't suffering, but the good doctor had promised a life of more indulgence, and I was of the irrepressible generation of May 1968, whose rebellious slogan was, Il est interdit d'interdire, it is forbidden to forbid. The answer, I would learn, was in the words petit and peu, which both mean little. You can have de tout un peu et de peu pas beaucoup, meaning you can have a little of everything, but in small portions. As I was proud of my results, but beginning to feel slightly underprivileged, Dr. Miracle made a minor adjustment. Twice a week, at lunch, which was normally at a sidewalk cafe with friends who, like me, couldn't handle the food of the restaurant universitaire, the school cafeteria, I could eat the little piece of dark chocolate, un palais or carré, that came with my espresso. I could pick the days, but not go over twice a week. Learn to pick your moments. After a hard test in the morning, I needed it. Ditto after declamation exercise in front of the class. It was a minor adjustment that gave me a big psychological lift. And it was my first peek at the power of slight recalibration. Little changes can make big differences in the long run. Zipper syndrome. By Easter, my recasting was complete, and I felt new things had become natural. Even now, I don't recall it as a savorless time of deprivation. But what had I accomplished? What can you expect to accomplish? I was down about 12 pounds, half of what I needed to lose. Mais, attention, I wasn't getting on the scale every day to track my progress. Scales are not a universal fixture of French bathrooms as they are in America, and they can be dispiriting indicators of progress. A woman gains weight with water retention during part of the month, Our weight can vary for other reasons, too, time of day, for instance, that have little to do with whether or not we are eating in balance. I did confirm the loss of kilos from time to time, but mainly I learned to be more attentive to the look and feel of my body in my clothes. I could see it was changing. And when the scale registered my loss of 12 pounds, it was only confirming what I seemed to know. I still find getting into some slim-cut pants the best indication of pounds melting. Much easier, more reliable, and sexier. Use what French women call le syndrome de la fermeture éclair, zipper syndrome, or use a measuring tape. Your equilibrium weight, as we have said, is very personal, depending on many factors like age, body type, and for some people even time of year. Likewise, improvements are relative, not absolute. Just as French women do not count calories, they mainly do not count pounds. You will have a sense after 3 months of recasting how far you have yet to go. If you feel you have met about half your goal, your recast has succeeded. If not, consider how far you are and continue for a few more weeks. Be wary of unrealistic goals. We can't all be model thin. Look for a few more trade-offs. A further reduction of some offenders, guaranteed to be easier once you've already done it. An additional 10 minutes of walking a day. Adjusting by small amounts is always the key to moving to your equilibrium. To empower this lifestyle fully requires that you embrace the rule of quality over quantity. Learning to cultivate quality is what we'll consider in the chapters ahead as we take up stabilization, a time when, remarkably, you will be enjoying more pleasures and still be losing weight. First, however, let's see recasting at work for a few American women I know. 4. The Tales of the Three C's. Let's revisit some of the basic principles of recasting. Look at your 3-week profile. Identify and reduce the offenders as much as you can without inducing shock. Whatever you can cut out completely without agony, just cut. Reduce others peu à peu, little by little. Eat at regular times. Look at portions of non-offender foods and trim these gradually too. Get to know the market, not the supermarket. Shop for food several times a week on a need-to-eat basis, but never when hungry. Diversify your foods with an eye to seasons. Increase the proportion of fresh fruits and vegetables. Introduce and experiment with a couple of new flavors. Prepare your own meals. Shun prepared foods, especially processed ones with artificial anything. Have a real breakfast. Eat slowly, sitting down. Chew well, even if it seems theatrical at first. Introduce 2 daily servings of homemade or all-natural plain yogurt as a dessert, breakfast, or snack food. Drink at least 2 more glasses of water per day, slipping in more as you find opportunity. Introduce a small but regular new physical movement, a daily walk or climbing stairs. If you go to a gym, you're probably doing enough in spandex, so pick something you can do in street clothes. Don't stock offenders at home. Develop a list and stock of food pacifiers, substitutes for offenders. Keep your en cas in your pocket for off-site emergencies. Choose and enjoy your weekend rewards. As I say, this is not radical, but to some it may still seem a little abstract at this point. The tendency toward abstraction is admittedly a French weakness. So let's see recasting in action. Let me introduce some friends. The three C's. Camille. Camille, 35, had been fighting her weight all her life. Obese she was not, but at her height, 5'2", those extra 25 pounds were obvious. She felt and looked chubby. At one time or another, she had tried every diet to come along. In the end, by her own analysis, the problem was simply genetic. Being overweight ran in the family. Her mother, in particular, had always been heavy. So deep down, Camille believed her attempts to lose weight were doomed. Camille joined Clicquot when we acquired another firm. She brought some excellent business skills and experience. The corporate world, however, can be brutal and unfair, especially the luxury goods business, in which image is critical. In all corporations, appearance counts a lot more for women than for men. Camille's job involved regular cross-country travel, including dinners with clients. She'd been with us for a year when it became obvious that her first New York winter had not been an easy adjustment. Bulky, cold-weather clothes had hidden some excesses, but once spring came around, I sensed a panic setting in as the next round of heavy travel and entertaining loomed. We had developed a nice rapport, and one day, when I asked her how it was going, she opened up to me. I told her about my own weight calamity as a young adult and how I was able to reverse it with some simple changes. She agreed to record her consumption for 3 weeks. I don't recommend jumping the gun, but it took only a glance at the first week's entries to spot some major offenders. First, there was beer. It seems Camille got thirsty every evening, whether at home or out of town. So she would have a bottle of beer, often around 11 p.m. Drinking beer late at night seemed odd to me, especially in someone who is having wine with meals in restaurants. Could Camille have a drinking problem? No, her alcohol consumption wasn't that excessive, and she gave no other indication of such a problem. I asked how long this nightly beer thing had been going on. Apparently, since college. She would buy salty snack foods from a machine while studying and wash them down at bedtime with a beer. After giving it some thought, she admitted she didn't really love it. It was just habit, and she was just thirsty. It was clear she had unthinkingly imported an old college habit into her adult life and retained it for 15 years. Always one to try the obvious first, I said, "If you're thirsty, why not drink water and then go to bed?" This seemed a no-brainer that could be worth between 5 and 10 pounds over some months if she would just recognize and tame this one offender. But it wasn't that easy. She wasn't madly craving the buzz or flavor of beer, but she did want something more interesting than water. Surprisingly, the solution for her was herbal teas. Her favorites became verbena and fresh mint, both soothing substitutes for the mildly sedative effect of bedtime beer. She was also eager to try new ones and became rather a connoisseur of teas. It took her longer to embrace drinking more plain old water during the day, key to reducing night thirst. So I suggested she just make a point of having a little paper cupful whenever she passed the cooler. When the effects began to show, she passed it more regularly. Another problem came from business. Not only was she eating airplane food, sort of a contradiction in terms, really, but she was eating it in addition to having dinner on the town. Apparently, whatever the flight attendants put in front of her, stale nuts, mystery meats, cloying desserts, she would eat. Know anyone like this? Even with a business dinner or lunch scheduled shortly after landing. This was a relatively easy offender to banish. She knew that plain food was horrible. Was she eating out of boredom? To pass the time? Anyway, I counseled her to have a small sandwich before boarding and to carry a bottle of chilled herbal tea she would brew the night before. Sipping it throughout the flight, as she listened to her own CDs, not piped in music, she passed the time contentedly. She was even able to nap on board for the first time in her life. I do it too. Whatever your seat assignment, the key is pushing liquids in the parched cabin air, which is good for hair frizz, but little else. Her third offender was a bit more complicated. A couple of times a week, especially on weekends, she would have a huge dish of pasta as her dinner. She said it seemed to her the easiest thing one could make and still have the comfort of home cooking. This was the voice of inexperience. Obviously, there were other ways of warding off the Sunday night blues. This problem called for a dramatic approach. No pasta at home for a while. But that meant finding things to cook that were equally satisfying and easy. As it was spring, the outdoor markets in New York City were a godsend. I showed her simple, delicious ways of cooking beets, fennel, broccoli, and carrots with accents like chopped herbs and lemon juice. The flavors of fresh vegetables in season dazzled her. Anyone who has ever had a farm fresh tomato will attest that with a little salt and olive oil, plus some chopped parsley or basil, that alone can seem like a meal. Making choices at her own pace and to her own taste, she found it wonderfully easy to increase her fruits and vegetables. Following a simple recipe for fish to come later, which, as a kitchen novice, she had never even attempted, she was enjoying at home a meal that would have seemed luxurious by most restaurant standards. She also found 20 minutes to walk each day from the office after work, as she was not a morning person. She would ordinarily have had one transfer, but she took the subway to the transfer point and walked home from there. After 3 months, she'd lost 10 pounds. On a small frame, it showed big time. And as she liked the changes she had made, she seemed in no imminent danger of gaining it back. In fact, she was eager to experiment with new ways of painlessly losing the rest. I noticed some new clothes, a self-confidence I had not seen before, and a happier face. Others noticed, too. Caroline was a generation older, and someone I met at a seminar for women business leaders. Most of her life, she had had no breakfast except a cigarette or two and a cup of coffee with double sugar. This, again, seemed like a college girl's habit, though Caroline's college days were long behind her. Now that she had quit smoking for good, after many failed attempts, she was starving in the morning. She had gained 10 pounds over the past year and seemed prepared to accept it, though crankily, as the inevitable trade-off for not smoking. Her non-smoker's breakfast was not much of an improvement. A glass of orange juice from the carton, a hit of pure sugar, 2 cups of coffee with 2 or more teaspoons of sugar each, sugar with coffee, really, and 2 biscotti, more sugar. Not only too sweet, but boring. Her diary also revealed a taste for dishes with heavy sauces, odd, given the relatively mild weather. The rest of her eating pattern wasn't too bad, though she suffered from the extremely common problems of not enough vegetables, fruit, or water. Her principal offender was sugar, in various forms, plain and hidden. She could never skip dessert, to which weakness I could easily relate. Less typical was her love of cheese. Having traveled a bit with her husband, she had a keen sense of quality, favoring some that might seem too pungent for the average American. Offenders can't be too personal. But she hadn't learned what a proper portion is. Here is where a little scale comes in handy. 3 ounces is a lot better than 8. Changing breakfast wasn't easy. Some of us can't quite start the day without coffee and cannot drink coffee without sugar. Often, though, this comes from drinking bad coffee, instant, freeze-dried, or reheated. Fewer need sugar, given the taste of freshly ground coffee, though it still can take a bit of an adjustment. With a cheap little coffee grinder, it took only 30 extra seconds to brew a luxurious, aromatic pot, and Caroline was able to reduce the sweetening progressively to 1/2 teaspoon by the 3rd week. She eliminated the orange juice gradually, 1/3 at a time over 3 weeks, replacing it with a fruit later in the day. The biscotti gave way to a slice of whole grain bread with a sliver of butter. People who would never dream of butter at breakfast don't understand what a luxury the smallest amount can seem. And to give it some heft that would hold her till lunch, we added yogurt, at first with a little drizzle of the acacia honey I had put her on to, but soon unsweetened. Sure enough, she was seeing breakfast now not as a sugar-charged jumpstart, but as a ritual of self-pampering. It put her in a sunnier mood to face the day. Dessert in restaurants was a challenge, Like many empty nest New Yorkers, she and her husband often ate out in the neighborhood for convenience sake, and there was always a sweet temptation among the specials. Fortunately, it was summer, and fresh berries, melons, and figs didn't seem a hardship, particularly when served with good yogurt, as they were at her local Greek restaurant. But when some baked or gooey confection beckoned, there was no need to fight it. Order one dessert, and slowly savor one or two forkfuls. The rest she could pass on to her husband or friends. Let them eat cake. The attraction to heavy sauces was weird. Actually, an old friend explained it to me when I noticed his preference for them while eating out in Paris. Smoking wreaks havoc on the olfactory mucous membranes, and these are slow to repair themselves even after we quit. Since aromas are more soluble in fatty dishes, taste buds naturally find such fare more satisfying when the smelling component of taste has been a bit incapacitated. So as not to deprive her of flavor, it was important then to reduce these fatty dishes ever so slowly for a while, and Caroline complied once she understood the problem. The nose also explained her overindulgence with pungent cheeses. When one is dining at someone's home in France, the cheese course is the only one that may be politely refused. This was too polite for Caroline's taste, however, so she started cutting back, little by little. She also started cooking with more pungent flavors, turmeric, curry, hot peppers, harder for her palate or her recovering nose to miss. In time, milder flavors would begin to register again. Caroline took to walking the 6 floors up to and down from her apartment whenever she had nothing to carry, and taking a 20-minute walk 3 times a week. She had no trouble learning to move like a typical French woman. 11 pounds came off in 10 weeks, and she had to allow that far from feeling deprived, she felt more self-indulgent than she could ever remember. Do her changes seem like deprivation to you? Connie's case was a bit more complicated. She was in her early 20s and very much unaware of what she was eating. She had grown up in the suburban Midwest, where food shopping was a twice-monthly affair, when her mother would load the fridge, the pantry, and especially the freezer with provisions for the next 2 weeks. Foodstuffs were just other items on a shopping list that included toilet paper and soap. On her own, Connie was buying the same brands of frozen entrees that were her mother's tried and true. Home-cooked dinner back home had been a Sunday ritual, the only meal shared en famille. During the week, everyone ate according to his or her busy schedule. Both parents are lawyers. Connie's mother had a handful of recipes she used again and again. They represented the comforts of home, so they became the only things Connie ever attempted to cook when she entertained friends in her studio walk-up. Otherwise, she had an unapologetic love of some all-American staples, burgers, pizza, cheddar cheese, Stouffer's lasagna. Supermarket cookies and pints of ice cream were always on hand, but nary a fresh vegetable or fruit. The drinks were soda. Encore soda, toujours soda. Not a pretty scenario. The fridge was packed with giant-sized soda bottles, both regular and diet. So when she wasn't pouring sugar into her body, she was imbibing an awful concoction of chemicals. When we met, she was starting her career in New York, and for the first time trying desperately to lose weight, a good 15 pounds. Oddly, she didn't feel so overweight in college girl clothes, which, as one may notice, have been much more revealing in the past 5 years. But in more demure professional attire, she never felt soignée. My word, admittedly, I can't remember hers. I got to know her working on a project with another firm, and when I took her out to lunch, she watched me with obvious puzzlement as I ate everything and sipped a glass of Veuve Clicquot. When they brought the coffee, she said rather sweetly, "May I ask you a very personal question?" I knew what was coming and encouraged her to dish. Like many young women, she had tried lots of deprivation diets without lasting success. On her last venture, a strict no-carb affair, she had eaten unprecedented portions of eggs, bacon, and cheese, some of her favorites. Finally, she would go off whatever diet it was, and without fail, the only lasting result was a bigger appetite for the things the diet had allowed her to have. She had also tried and failed to burn off weight through punishing workouts. Someone had told her that if she spent 1 hour a day on some machine, her eating habits wouldn't matter. Connie had just bought a 3-month membership to a gym, with every cent she wasn't spending on her New York rent. I never fail to marvel at the willingness of Americans to pound away at a Stairmaster for hours rather than make a few relatively painless adjustments. Connie had lost a couple of pounds, but her daily machine regimen was like working on a chain gang, and she quit after a few weeks, subsequently gaining the weight back. I suggested she continue going to the gym, since she had paid for it and would probably hate herself for bagging it altogether. But I counseled moderation. A half hour of something aerobic 3 times a week, no more, and not the same 3 things every week. She would also have to change some of her eating habits ASAP. As it was the dead of winter, the magical leek soup kickoff seemed absolutely de rigueur. It would be tougher on someone who lived on her kind of food, I thought, but it would be good for her morale to get a quick start. By the following Monday morning, she had achieved what had taken 2 weeks of forced labor at the gym. 2 pounds, mostly water, true, but nevertheless 2 pounds were gone. It was indeed a boost to her spirits. But something even more remarkable happened. She had discovered a new pleasure. "I can't believe how delicious leeks are. I just love them," she told me. Even I was a bit surprised. In fact, long after her first weekend of eating like a Frenchwoman, Connie would from time to time gladly have leek soup for lunch. Connie described her first 3 months as almost effortless, practically entertaining. The kind of cooking I introduced her to was a deliciously diverting novelty. Winter is a wonderful time for hearty fare, and she especially enjoyed the luxury of my easy chicken au champagne, recipe to come. But the fruits and vegetables are also great. She loved to poach pears. Couldn't believe a fat-free dessert you can make in 8 to 10 minutes could be this good. Just place pears in a pot of boiling water with red wine and a touch of cinnamon and sugar and let cool. Recipe to come. She even served it to friends who went gaga. Because her diet had been as bland and fattening as any I've seen, the substitutions she made were quick to take effect. According to the rules, she never allowed herself to be hungry. For maximum satisfaction, we tried to confine the high-fat foods to snacks, nutritious and satisfying handfuls of nuts and small cubes of cheese. As for her new adventures in the kitchen, these were much lower in fat, but much higher in previously unfamiliar flavors, anise, hazelnut oil instead of olive oil on mesclun. And so, lucky girl, she didn't even miss burgers and pizza. She still had them once or twice a week when eating out, but with her growing awareness of possibilities, they began to seem too dull to eat more often. And in time, the portion control even of those varied offenders was automatic. After a month, 2 slices of pizza for lunch, formerly her usual, just seemed too heavy and greasy. Her diet sodas were no asset, but not an immediate problem either. I let her wean herself off them, replacing them with a little fresh fruit juice diluted with seltzer. Sometimes it's healthier overall to add a few calories for the sake of quality. Connie was fortunate in terms of how easily she could switch off her offenders and make substitutions. Her case shows the importance of assessing yourself as an individual rather than following a diet. Each of us has strengths and weaknesses. What is relatively easy for you may be hard for someone else, and vice versa. And of course, what tickles your fancy may not tickle another's as much, or as we say in French, à chacun son goût, to each his or her taste. One thing that really tickled Connie as she developed her sense of food was presentation. Over the summer, she had worked for a very fancy caterer whose creations for weddings and other events had to be not just delicious, but gorgeous to behold. The attention to detail appealed to Connie's meticulous personality, and it opened her eyes to what the French mean by the word menu. Not just a list of options, but a selection of little dishes. The order of food, the arrangement of food on the plate, can often dramatically affect our experience, especially our sense of a proper portion. A tuna carpaccio, artfully formed, can be much more satisfying to eat than the same amount scattered on a plate like the dog's supper. This is part of Les Rites de la Table I discuss in the following chapter. After her first 3 weeks, Connie had lost 4 pounds and was already full of new energy. Her mood had changed, too. 4 pounds on the average woman's frame is significant, and she felt herself starting to slide in her clothes. She immediately wanted to buy something in the next size down, but I convinced her to wait. If experience was any indication, she'd be down another size before long. Et alors? Getting started. 3 examples do hardly a recipe for success make, but that is the point. In this strategy for weight loss and wellness a la française, there are no recipes, only ingredients. As with good cooking, the result will depend on what you use and what pleases you. There are some elements that apply to all cases, a little more walking, a little more water, for instance. But otherwise, the approach is unapologetically individualist and will depend somewhat on trial and error. The key is to cultivate your own intuition of your offenders and pleasures and adjust each accordingly by degrees that suit you. Consider it your vote for the Franco-American ideal of individual liberty over the tyrannical regime of one-size diets. For this reason, 3 months is the usual time to find your way. But you must enjoy the ride. 3 months of hardcore dieting might well be enough to crush any woman's spirit, but 3 months of discovering new things and getting to know your body better is a kindness to yourself that will continue to be repaid for years to come. We have not and will not be judging our successes by obsessive attention to calories, carbohydrates, proteins, fats, lipids, glucose, or other chemical structures or units. Most French women are not like Madame Curie and would be bored to tears reading about such things, much less applying them to one of the most sacred parts of life, food. Remember to tiptoe onto the bathroom scale only once in a while, but not daily. Judge your progress by your eyes and hands, using your clothes and your mirror as guides. And use the food scale to get to know 1 to 5 ounce portions, whether it's fish, meat, or dessert, particularly pie and cake. Approaching your equilibrium weight, bien dans ta peau, is a natural and intuitive progression, a course of fine-tuning that embraces both discovery and moderation. I am happy to report that years later, Connie looks terrific and ready for the pages of Vogue. Caroline has maintained her equilibrium, perhaps a couple of pounds below the set point I would have picked for her, but she's happy. And Camille? I've lost track of her and have often wondered. Of the three, she was the least happy to begin with, too reliant on food as therapy and heredity as an excuse. But if she has maintained her new optimism, I'd bet she's fine now. Having read to this point, you should have enough strategies to start recasting. But we have plenty more in stock. Allons-y! Entracte. Stabilization and eating for life. Mangez bien et juste. Eat well and eat right. Molière. Your 3 months should bring you at least halfway toward your target equilibrium weight, even further if your recasting goals are modest. Again, you should pay attention to yourself, your eyes, complexion, state of mind, and above all, clothes. These will tell you where you are. If you are there, and only you can tell for sure, Brava! You are ready for stabilization. If you feel you are not yet halfway, however, you should extend your recasting as you see fit. A good dressmaker will always require you to come in for several fittings. With each, the alterations become more subtle. If you continue to recast, see where you might be prepared to take it in a little for the sake of continued progress. But always bear in mind the golden rules. Fais-toi plaisir. Take your pleasures and diversions. Keep reducing what you can, peu à peu. While you may have reached some levels of consumption you would have considered unrealistic 3 months ago, for instance, only 2 slices of bread a day, your contentment may well extend into even smaller amounts, 1 slice. Experimentation is the only way to find out how little you need to feel satisfied. Assuming successful recasting, you are ready to start increasing your share of the things you enjoy. You are ready for stabilization. This again is governed entirely by an understanding of your personal cost-pleasure-benefit analysis. You may feel virtuous having stuck mainly to less fattening desserts for 3 months, as I did under Dr. Miracle. But now, you'd like to enjoy something ultra-luscious with a bit more regularity, not just on the weekend. Guess what? You've earned it. 3 months of steady progress is bound to coincide with a much greater awareness of your own nutrition and appetites. You are now more familiar with what you like and why. So it's only fair and in keeping with our pleasure principle that you reward yourself. Does this necessarily mean you will stop losing weight? Pas du tout. If that happens, simply backtrack and do a little more incremental cutting. Even have yourself a magical leak weekend if need be to rally the troops. But if you ramp up as carefully as you cut back, you can easily continue to slim down while enjoying more of what you love most. The only way to get rid of a temptation is to yield to it, observed Oscar Wilde, who died in Paris. Well, he is right to some extent. Eating is a sensual pleasure. So after the 3 months, it's natural that we would want some more sizzle as we stabilize for life. How? It's simply a matter of taking from Peter to pay Paul. When you add an indulgence, make a corresponding reduction to compensate. Add another half hour of walking the next day. Skip the cocktail. Pass the breadbasket. Just as you've become attuned to where your greatest pleasures come from, you will also have come to know which compensations work best for you. Keep your balance week by week. French women seem to know by instinct, but as with any magic trick, it's really just a matter of practice. The key to continued weight loss is keeping one's compensations just slightly ahead of one's indulgences. This French practice of fooling yourself allows you to maximize your impression of pleasure, and if you do it right, voila! The compensations will seem trivial by comparison. The net effect is a feeling of contentment and never of deprivation. Your mind must be your partner in keeping your weight at equilibrium, and as the philosophes would concur, you could not have a more powerful ally in this game. But let me not journey into the abstract. The key to further progress and a lifetime of healthy eating lies in a deeper understanding of what French women know. You've had French for beginners. Now, it's time for the next level or two. 5. Il faut des rites. Saint-Exupéry's Le Petit Prince is a book all French people know well. It can be read in an hour, but is packed with timeless wisdom. In Le Petit Prince, the fox explains to the little prince, Il faut des rites. We need rituals. As the French know well, ritual is how we give meaning to different aspects of being alive, including the most elemental, birth, marriage, death, and through it all, until the end, eating. There are, of course, holiday rituals, like the Galette des Rois, eaten on the 12th night of Christmas to commemorate the 3 kings. But there are also rites quotidiens, the rituals of everyday life by which a civilization defines itself, like le pain quotidien, our daily bread, or even brushing our teeth. Whether aware of it or not, we spend most of our waking hours performing our daily rituals. In a world in which everything continues to change ever faster, these rituals are a frame of reference as well as a source of comfort and reassurance. They are also key to our well-being, part of our cultural programming about what is right and good, the norms around which we form our own tastes. Americans have some superb gastronomic rituals. Nothing French can quite compete with a hamburger barbecued on a Sunday afternoon in summer. In fact, lots of French people adore hamburgers, as well as sirloin steaks. A few even like corn on the cob, though in France that is usually reserved for livestock. But America is a relatively young country by European standards, and, being a great nation of immigrants, much less uniform as to its gastronomic norms. While this multitude of influences has produced many delicious results, America still lags in developing the sort of coherent principles of eating that only 1,000 years of history could achieve. Even among the oldest nations of Europe, France is distinguished in the evolution of its gastronomic rituals. Where else might you be drawn into heated debates over whether the best coffee macaroons were to be found at the Pâtisserie Le Duret or Fauchon or Pierre Hermé? The intensity still brings an impish smirk to the face of my American husband, Edward. Quality is a passion, even a compulsion. In the late 18th century, as the bourgeoisie headed off the aristocracy, les arts de la table were born. A new code, governing everything from seating arrangements to presentation to the principles of flavor harmony, our sense of what complements what. The table became a spectacle. Standard dishes received their classical names, and there followed a rush of innovation, imitation, and indeed fashion. Few Americans, even Michelin-guided gastro-tourists, really appreciate the extent to which our cooking is like our couture. For all our insistence on the permanence and perfection of the classics, eating would become unbearably dull if we did not remain committed to renewing and enlivening it continually. This value has often been lost at American-French restaurants, in which the same old warhorses of cuisine bourgeoise and the bistro are typically trotted out year after year. The French enjoy eating out in a special way, knowing that what they savor today may never again appear on the menu. They treat every meal as something special, and this is what you must learn to do too. Having matured over the centuries, French gastronomic culture is for the first time endangered because of globalization. With transnational fast food outlets appearing in all our cities, it is becoming more difficult to transmit our proudly evolved values to our children. Sometimes it seems we are headed back to the Renaissance, when we ate with our fingers, helped ourselves unceremoniously from communal heaps of food, even gnawed on a bone before passing it to a neighbor. Okay, j'exagère, but if anything could launch a French obesity epidemic such as what has struck America, the loss of traditional values is the most likely culprit. For this reason, tradition must be honored and promoted for the betterment of all. 3 meals a day, 3-course dinners. The traditional French meal is still a 3-course affair, often with an additional course of cheese before the dessert. In a grand restaurant, it is not strange to have several more courses. Why don't French women, or men for that matter, get fat? The reason is that we have adapted traditional eating to modern living, which typically includes less than traditional levels of exertion. We eat grandly on occasion, not regularly. Our courses are greater in number, but smaller in size. Very important, even an ordinary meal partakes to a degree of the formality of tradition. In the recasting section, I preach the importance of not multitasking while you eat. No TV, newspaper, or eating at the wheel or on the subway. I also suggested that some formalities can enhance the dining experience and make eating less seem more meaningful. This is the power of presentation, which includes the use of china, glassware, and table linens. Candlelight is a nice touch, too, though really an American tradition that is now all the rage in France. If the added bother strikes you as senseless extra effort, you are missing the point. Setting one's table can be nearly as important as preparing the food. It focuses the mind on what lies ahead and whets the appetite, opening it to a fuller experience. The French word menu not only means bill of fare, for which la carte is the more common term in France, but also little. And by its use in relation to food, we mean to suggest our sense of small offerings. The essence of French gastronomy is to have a little of several things, rather than a lot of one or two. This is the exact opposite of the American sense of portion. Remember Camille's huge dish of pasta. Let us consider the French plate. It's strange to us to have a whole meal on one dish. Stranger still to see any plate covered with food. The arrangement of a course in the center of the plate is part of French enjoyment. Changing plates not only compels you to concentrate on what you are enjoying at that moment, it slows the meal down, improving digestion and promoting contentment. The faster you eat, the more you'll need. If washing an extra plate seems a bother, how does it compare with getting fat? Our menu servings are what allow us to enjoy, now and then, the full production of haute cuisine, including amuse-bouche, starter, first course, main course, cheese course, dessert, petit four, the works. But mind you, these are not Louis XIV-style affairs. If the courses were not menu, we would never survive them. Even rising from the most elaborate meal, the French feel content, never stuffed. Nowadays, many French still eat the main meal at lunch. This may not be practical for you. Nevertheless, three meals a day are a must to set the body's metabolism at a steady rate. Snacking, which results mainly from not having three proper meals, is generally an unhelpful expedient that confuses us, body and mind. If you are not especially hungry in the morning, don't be deceived into thinking you can get away with a faux breakfast. You'll only eat out of proportion later in the day. I've seen lots of young women who have nothing but coffee in the morning and work through lunch, if they can make it through the 11 o'clock coffee and pastry break, with an eye to an indulgent night out with friends. It might seem they are compensating earlier for pleasures to be taken later. In fact, pleasure should, as a rule, precede compensation. But in reality, the one-meal-a-day gals are only fooling themselves, and not in a good way. They are famished by dinner time, when the party often begins with a colored drink, hard liquor, sugary syrup, empty calories that dull the senses. These cocktails should carry the Surgeon General's warning. Then comes the typical restaurant meal, featuring oversized portions of dishes made with all the tricks of the bad chef, too much salt and fat, and sugar hidden even in the savory courses. How much? Who knows? We can't send dinner to the lab for analysis. The takeout option can be the same mystery grab bag. Save dining out for occasions and choose quality. Good restaurants are exceptional. Eat at home otherwise. Mangez bien et juste. Know thy food and know thyself. 6. The seasons and the seasonings. Les fraises d'antan. The strawberries of yesteryear. There were no strawberries at the first Thanksgiving. Wild New England cranberries, perhaps. Strawberries, no. The pilgrims naturally worked with local produce and what was in season. So did our grandparents and more remote ancestors. Tomatoes in December? Try South America. Canning and mass global distribution of produce have conditioned us to expect all foods all year round. I myself have been beguiled by the engineered good looks of off-season produce, but one taste of cardboard is enough to send me reaching for my napkin to expel the offending counterfeit. Nothing is more flavorless than a supermarket tomato in winter, but a true vine-ripened specimen in summer is nothing short of divine. There is a reason to have pumpkin pie with Thanksgiving turkey, and not with 4th of July hot dogs. Seasonality is all about adapting your eating to what is available at markets for a short time during specific months of the year. The rhythm of the season is a vital part of tuning our bodies to their equilibrium, cultivating well-being. In summer, for example, our bodies naturally welcome a salad composed of the freshest greens, the most fragrant tomatoes. Fresh corn and succulent berries delight us, each full of nutrients but also cooling water, which we lose faster in warm weather. In fall and winter, we will naturally yearn for more concentrated energy to keep warm and on the move. We want more proteins, and so happily begins the season for oysters, seafood, warm, hearty soups, dried beans and lentils, and more meat. In the end, seasonality is the key to the French woman's psychological pleasure in food, the natural pleasure of anticipation, change, the poignant joy we take in something we know we shall soon lose and cannot take for granted. Such heightened awareness of what we put in our mouths is the opposite of routine, mindless eating that promotes boredom and weight gain. The first soft-shell crabs of the season are a singular treat. The first strawberries can trigger a precious memory as we hearken back to seasons past. And this applies to things we make, as well as to produce. As I write this passage, it is Christmas Eve. From the window of our Paris apartment, we can see a famous pastry shop, Moulot, where about 60 people under umbrellas are patiently lined up in the rainy street, waiting to collect their bouche de Noël, the Yule log cake. Believe me, they are not annoyed to be there. Au contraire. Only in France, you might say, and unfortunately, you'd be right. The cake is rich and fattening and delicious, and no French woman would do without a slice or two. Made to be eaten only a few days a year, it is a tradition no one skips. And with a cultivated sense of balance, no one needs to. Au marché. Whether in the French provincial villages, cities, or Paris itself, on certain days of the week you can always see the trucks in the local squares and lining the streets. This caravan,